Friday, we finished off talking about a bit about computational complexity. So today we're going to talk some more about computational complexity, about the class NP, and this notion of black boxes, which we'll be using at least to get started thinking about quantum algorithms. And the first algorithm we'll see is one for something called the Deutsch-Joser problem, which gives an example of exponential speedup by quantum computers in this black box model. Okay, and just to recap the kind of picture of some of the basic complexity classes that we saw last time, we had these few different complexity classes that sit one inside another. So P, remember, is the things you can do in polynomial time deterministically on a classical computer. Then we can consider allowing randomness, and we get the class BPP. If we consider a quantum computer running in polynomial time, we have BQP. And then there were these bigger classes that didn't correspond to polynomial time computation. So P space, which is things we could do in polynomial space, and exp, which is things we could do in exponential time. So, you know, really this resource of having exponential time sounds like it's a lot better than having only polynomial time. You ought to be able to compute a lot more things. And indeed, this is the case. So we know that these two classes are different, but actually that's the only separation we know among all of these classes. So, you know, really it's very hard to separate complexity classes and to prove that different modes of computation really give you different power. And so, you know, this kind of hopefully gives you a sense of how little we actually know about computational complexity. Okay, so I wanted to mention, you know, before we go on to talking about quantum algorithms, this class NP, because actually it doesn't have, I mean, you'll see there's not so much we can say about how it relates to the power of quantum computers, but this class NP is a very important one in computational complexity theory, and, you know, a very natural kind of question you might ask if you've heard about NP and the notion of NP-complete problems, which I'll mention, is, you know, could you solve these NP-complete problems in polynomial time on a quantum computer? So that would be asking something about this class BQP. And so we'll see that the situation is, you know, not so obvious. So anyway, this is where we'll get to when we introduce NP. So are there any questions, kind of basic questions about the lay of the land? Okay, great. So let's introduce the class NP. So remember what a complexity class is. So we have this framework where we think about computational problems as languages that we want to recognize. So a language is a subset of the set of all strings of any length, all Boolean strings with values 0 and 1 for each character. And so, you know, a complexity class describes the set of languages that we can recognize with some particular model of computation. And in NP, we have some additional resource which is given to us, which is a witness. So in order to tell whether a string is in the language or is not in the language, we're going to be given some additional information beyond just the input. Someone who, you know, maybe wants to convince us that the string indeed is in the language is going to give us some kind of advice. But we can't necessarily trust that advice. So we have to, you know, we have to check it, and we're restricted to polynomial time computations in order to do this checking. So let's see. So we say a language L is in NP if, okay, so there has to be some kind of a polynomial time, and this will just be a classical algorithm that we can use for checking. Okay, so there is a poly time. So, polynomial time, again, will just mean running in a time which grows like at most some polynomial in the length of the input, right? So the input would be some string that might or might not be in the language, and you want to tell which is the case. So there's a poly time algorithm, which, you know, you can formalize what you mean by an algorithm. You know, it should be described maybe by a uniform family of circuits or by a Turing machine or something like this. And let me write that algorithm as A of x, y. So it takes two inputs. One is the string x, which you want to tell whether it's in the language or not. And the other is some other string y, which is this advice string that I was talking about. So this is something that you're going to use to try to, you know, assist you in figuring out whether x is indeed in the language. So what this you know, a of x, y means is it's some function which gets computed by some polynomial, you know, say some polynomial size circuit, and then it either accepts or rejects x using this information from the witness y. Okay, so what should this algorithm do? So that behaves as follows. Okay, well, there are two possibilities. X could be in the language or could not be in the language. And what you want is to, you know, you want to get the right answer, but you have this Y to help you. So So first of all, if x is in the language, so this is a, you know, yes instance of the problem, then it should be the case that there exists some y that someone could give you to convince you that x is in the language. Okay, so then there exists y. I'm not writing like the sets that these come from. I mean, this is some, you know, n-bit string where n is the problem size, and this is some string of some length. You know, for it to be useful to you, it better be only of polynomial length so that you can actually read the whole thing. But it could be a long string that helps you potentially a lot in figuring out whether x is in the language. So if x is in the language, there should exist some witness string y that you can feed into the algorithm so that it will accept. So a of xy accepts. So this is sometimes called completeness. It says that if x is a, you know, is a yes instance, you should be able to be convinced by some proof. Okay, so you should think about this y as some efficiently checkable proof that x is indeed in the language. Okay, and then on the other hand, if x is not in the language, then it should not just be the case that, you know, for one particular y you'll reject. Actually, no matter what y you're given, you should reject. Because the idea is that maybe someone is always trying to convince you that the string is in the language, and you can't trust them. So you have to actually do some polynomial time verification to figure out whether the witness is actually a good witness. I mean, you have to be able to check that it really is a proof. So this y that you use here in the yes instance is like a, you know, an efficiently verifiable proof, but you shouldn't be fooled by false proofs. Okay, so then for all y, a of xy should reject. So y, this y that you use here is some kind of an efficiently verifiable proof. Okay, so, you know, what's an example of a problem in NP? Well, for example, you know, if we think about factoring, if we made some decision version of factoring so that it was just a yes-no problem, you know, that's a problem in NP because, you know, if someone wants to convince you that some number factors into some particular product of primes, well, they could just give you the individual primes, and you could easily, in polynomial time, multiply them together and check that indeed they multiply to the input. You know, here, so here x is the number that you're being asked to factor, and y is the factorization, right? So if someone gives you the factorization, they can convince you that indeed that is the factorization. And on the other hand, there's no way that they can give you some product of numbers that will, some factorization that will fool you, because if they give you a wrong factorization, you multiply the numbers together and you'll see, hey, this doesn't come out to the number x that I was given. You know, you must be trying to fool me, so I'm actually going to reject. Okay? So this is the notion of NP. Are there questions about this? Okay. So, one of the interesting things about NP, so, you know, we would like to understand sort of what the relationship is between P and NP. So the things that we can, you know, compute in polynomial time ourselves, and the things where, you know, we have this additional power given to us, and we only have to check that the answer is right. So, you know, there's a very natural question, which are the problems where all you know is that you can easily check that the answer is right, can those problems be harder than the problems where you have to come up with the answer yourself? And you would expect that the answer is yes. I mean, it's much easier to check things than to come up with them in the first place. So we would like to think that maybe there are some problems here that are actually hard. And there's a notion of reducibility that allows us to at least get some more evidence for this being the case. So let me just define what it means for one problem to reduce to another, or for one language to reduce to another. So we say that a language L is polytime reducible to a language L prime if, you know, we can translate, so if we're given some string so there's some translation that we can apply to strings that we should think of as coming from this language to, you know, instances of, so, If we're given some instance of the problem that this language describes, there's some polynomial time transformation that we can do to turn it into an instance of the problem that this language describes, so that you know, deciding whether the string is in this language reduces to deciding whether the string is in this language. So if for any input, so I want to say that there exists a transformation. So if there is a polytime computable function, so say computable by a classical computer, so that, and I have to try to get this in the right order, so I guess we want that x is in L if and only if f of x is in L prime. Okay? So what this means is that if we want to decide, you know, we're given some input x, and we want to decide if that is in L, then, well, what we could do is we could compute this function f, and then we get some string f of x. And if we can figure out whether that's in L prime, that tells us whether x is in L. And since this function can be computed in polynomial time, you know, if we have some polynomial time procedure to decide whether strings are in L prime, then this would give us a polynomial time procedure to decide whether strings are in L. Right? And notice it doesn't necessarily go the other way, because you could imagine that there are functions that are easy to compute in one direction but hard to invert. Right? So if we can't necessarily easily, you know, compute the inverse of f, then this doesn't necessarily let us use an algorithm for deciding whether strings are in L to decide whether strings are in L prime. Okay? So now, what's interesting is that there's this notion of complete problems for a complexity class. So you can think about, imagine that you had some problem, so described by some language, so that if you could decide instances from that language, you could actually decide any language in the complexity class. So we say a language, I mean, let me describe this in particular for the class NP. So is NP complete if any language in L, sorry, any language in NP reduces to it? So a language which is NP complete is one which is like the hardest, in some sense, the hardest kind of language in NP. Because if you could decide that language, you could actually decide any NP language. Okay, so these are like the hardest problems in NP. And it turns out that actually there are many problems of great practical significance that are NP complete. So you can prove this, and we're not going to talk about the details of how you do this here. But you can give reductions which say that that there are NP complete problems. So there's sort of a trivial NP complete problem that you can reduce some problem to. So there's something called the Cook-Levin theorem, which says that a particular problem called 3-sat, which is the problem of deciding whether some form of Boolean formula is satisfiable, this problem is NP complete. And then once you know that, you can start coming up with reductions to show that many, many problems are NP complete. And, you know, so there are many others. For example, 3-coloring. So if you're given some graph and you want to know whether it's possible to 3-color it, assign colors to the vertices such that no two adjacent vertices have the same color. Or for example, so there's something called the traveling salesman problem, which maybe you've heard about, which is a problem having to do with, you know, optimizing the way a salesman might walk around some space, maybe on some graph, in order to deliver packages in some optimal way. And there are many problems of, you know, practical significance and problems of mathematical interest as well, which are NP complete. And so these are problems that we would really like to solve. They're important problems, but we have this evidence that they're hard, because they're the hardest problems in the class NP. And in fact, no efficient algorithm is known for any NP complete problem. And so we strongly suspect that these problems are hard. In fact, the best algorithms that are known, the best classical, in fact, or quantum algorithms that are known, take exponential time. So, so the best known algorithms for NP complete problems take exponential time. But of course, we don't know how to prove that the best algorithm takes exponential time. Well, if we could do that, it would resolve this P versus NP problem, which is a major open problem in computer science, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. Okay, so we really kind of suspect that these problems are hard. Now, factoring, which was an example of an NP kind of problem that I mentioned before, is actually not, it's not thought to be an NP-complete problem. Well, we don't know that it's NP, whether it's NP-complete or not, but it's suspected to not be NP-complete. So, you know, we could ask about the relationship between this notion of problems in NP and problems that are NP-complete and quantum computing. So that's what I want to just say something about briefly. So let's try to make some kind of a picture of, again, of how complexity classes relate to each other, now taking NP into account. So first of all, we have P. This is kind of our basic class that we think about. NP, of course, is, you know, is some kind of a superset of P, because surely, you know, everything that you can do in P, you can also do in NP, because you can just ignore the witness, right? So if you can just solve the problem yourself, then you know, you don't need the witness. So certainly everything that's in P is in NP. We sort of suspect that there might be things in NP that are not in P, but we don't know. And then there's there's BQP. Now remember, P sits inside BQP. So the sort of the generic picture, if we just sort of put things in general position, then we might think that BQP would look like this if there were no particular relationship between BQP and NP. And this is actually sort of what the conventional wisdom suggests the picture actually does look like. So again, you know, it's very hard to prove things about the relationships between complexity classes, but I'll tell you what the conventional wisdom is. So first of all, that P doesn't equal NP. Okay, so we don't know how to prove this. You could argue that it's maybe the biggest open problem in mathematics, because of course, if it were the case that P were equal to NP, this would mean that there is an efficient algorithm for coming up with proofs of things. This is sort of like the main task of mathematics, right? So if P were equal to NP, I mean, it would be very surprising, because it would say that you could come up with proofs in polynomial time. You could come up with them yourself, right? Even if you weren't given this witness. So this is the conventional wisdom. We don't know whether this is the case, and it's a really important open problem. But then the other thing we could ask about is the relationship between NP and BQP, right? So on the one hand, you know, if quantum computers could solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time, that would be fantastic, because then we could use quantum computers to come up with proofs of things. But I think that would also be very surprising. So the conventional wisdom is actually that NP is not contained within BQP. There's no particular reason to think that quantum computers would give us some kind of magic ability to solve NP-complete problems. And we'll see some kind of evidence for something like this in a few lectures. It'll be very weak evidence for this. I mean, in general, we just don't know how to prove statements like this. And in particular, of course, if we could prove that quantum computers can't solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time, it would mean, in particular, that classical computers can't solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time. And that's already, I said that's like the biggest open problem in mathematics. So probably the best way to prove this conjecture is not to first prove that quantum computers can't solve NP-complete problems fast. Yes? This is set containment, right? So remember that a complexity class is just a set of languages. So if I write something like this, it says, the languages in NP, the set of languages in NP. Well, if I wrote like this, without the slash, that would mean that the set of languages in NP is a subset of, or possibly equal to, the set of languages in BQP. Oh, this just allows for the possibility that they're equal. This is like the difference between, x is less than y and x is less than or equal to y. It's also suspected that they're not equal. So, I mean, if I just wrote this, I guess, this is also thought to be true, but I guess an even stronger thing is this. Okay, and then you could also ask about the other direction. So, quantum computers can't solve NP-complete problems, and maybe, the set of things you can do with a quantum computer is actually a strict subset of what you can do with NP, right? Because this ability to, solve a problem being given this kind of magical help of a witness, this seems like a pretty powerful thing. But on the other hand, if you think about it for a little bit, how would you give a witness that a particular quantum computation gave a particular value? Because you couldn't, the witness couldn't describe the whole quantum state, because, even if it did, that wouldn't be something you could process in polynomial time. And in general, it just doesn't seem like this ability to, you know, only have to check a proof has really that much at all to do with the power of quantum computers. So actually, I mean, this is here we're maybe on a little bit shakier ground, but I think it's fair to say that the conventional wisdom also is that probably, you know, BQP is not contained within NP. So not only are there things you can do on a quantum computer, not only are there things in NP that you can't do with a quantum computer, but probably there are things you can do with a quantum computer that you can't do in NP. You know, even if you have this kind of you know, extreme ability of only having to worry about checking a witness. Some you know, magical prover is giving you a witness. So this, as I say, is the conventional wisdom of how these things relate to one another. I mean, when you start thinking about quantum computing, it's very natural to ask whether maybe quantum computers would be able to solve NP-complete problems, but we really think that this is probably not the case. So this is kind of the main message that I want to get across. Okay, questions? Other questions? Yes. Yeah, so factorization is a problem that if you were to make up some decision version of it, it would be a problem in NP. But it's thought not to be an NP-complete problem. So what would the witness be? The witness would be the factorization, basically, right? So you know, to work in this framework, we have to have a decision problem, and the answer is yes or no. And you know, the decision problem could be something like, is there a factor bigger than some particular value, right? So that would be a yes-no problem. And a way that you could prove to someone that there is a factor of a particular size would be to just give them the factorization, right? If you just tell them the factorization, they can easily check that it's the factorization just by multiplying the numbers together. And for these other problems, I mean, maybe some of these other problems, you know, it would help to think about what the witness would be. So for example, for three coloring, you know, the witness could just be the three coloring of the graph. And then you can go check for all the, you know, quadratically many pairs of vertices that indeed the two colors are different at the two ends of the edge. That's what it has to be the case for it to be a valid three coloring. And you know, if you were given a good witness, you'll find that that was actually the case.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's probably the right way to think about it. Yeah. I mean, in principle, there's nothing that requires it to be that. It could be something that somehow encodes in some very tricky way some information that you could use to check. But typically, that's what would happen, is that if you want to show that some particular problem is an NP, the witness would be some kind of straightforward encoding of what the answer to the problem is. Yeah. OK, good. Other questions? OK, so this is it for kind of you know, complexity classes. And next, I want to mention this notion of black boxes, because we're going to use this when we start to develop quantum algorithms. Okay, so far we've been talking about computational problems in this setting where the input is some string and you want to decide whether it's in a language or not. And you know, we could talk about problems that are not decision problems, where you don't want to just decide whether some string is in a language, you want to evaluate some more complicated function. But you know, this is basically the kind of way we usually think about computation. We're given some explicit input as a string and we want to compute some function of that string. Okay, but on the one hand, I mean, so this is the model we sort of really care about, but on the other hand, it can be difficult to reason about problems like this. So you know, we have this vast landscape of complexity classes, and we kind of can't prove anything about, or we can't prove much about how they relate to one another. So this concept of black box computation is a different model where we can actually say a lot more about the complexity of problems. So this notion of the black box you should think of as like a handle that we can use to be able to actually prove lower bounds, showing that problems are hard. And so by thinking about encoding the problem in a black box, we get some kind of model that we can at least use to get some intuition about the relationship between different kinds of computation, even if it's not the, you know, even if there are no black boxes lying around in the real world and it's not really the model that we most care about. Okay, so what is the idea? So the model is that instead of being given the input explicitly, the input is hidden inside a black box. So there's an input string, x. So for the most part, we can think about the case where this is just a string of bits. I think for all the problems that we look at in detail, this will actually be the case that it's a string of bits, although you could consider a model where you, every time you query, you get you get more than just one bit. Okay, but let's consider the case where the input string here is a string of bits, and it's hidden by a black box. So you're not explicitly given x, It's not written down for you on a piece of paper. Rather, you're given some kind of a device that you can make queries to learn information about X. So how does the box behave? Well, you're given, what you can do is you can take some index I. So I would be some value from 1 through n that indexes the possible bits of the string. So it's an n-bit string. So I labels one of the possible bits. And then you feed that into the box. And out of the box comes the value x sub I. Okay, so you're given the ability to do this. And now the problem will be to determine some property of the string x that's hidden by this black box. This will be part of what the problem is, to say what that property is. But you want to determine some property of the string inside the black box using only the ability to make these queries without knowing x explicitly. And what we'll do to simplify things is we'll only count the queries that we make. So what we want to do is determine some property of x using queries. And we want to use as few queries as possible. So that'll be our measure of complexity. But we won't count other operations. Okay, so don't count other gates. So this simplifies things a lot because we only have to think about, the number of queries that we make. So if we want to come up with an algorithm, we can come up with an algorithm in the usual way by combining the normal gates that we know how to do along with the ability to use these kinds of gates. And of course, if we come up with an efficient algorithm that's efficient in the sense that not only do we use a small number of these gates, but we use a small number of other operations, then we actually have an efficient algorithm in the usual sense. If we're able to, efficiently compute the function that this represents. So, if we had some situation where this wasn't actually a black box, but it represented some function that we knew how to compute efficiently, and if we didn't need to make too many queries, and if the number of other operations that we used was actually small, then we could actually use this black box algorithm in some practical setting where we really have some explicit problem. And on the other hand, if we want to prove that some problem is hard, well, now we have this ability to think about how many queries would we need to make, and this gives us a handle that we can use to prove lower bounds. So potentially for some problem, we could prove that we need a lot of queries in order to solve whatever the problem is, and that would give us some evidence that problem is hard. Well, it would show us that the problem is hard in the black box model. And if we had some kind of a black box abstraction of an explicit computational problem, then maybe we could think of that as some kind of evidence that maybe the problem is even hard in the model where you're given an explicit input. But of course, it wouldn't be a proof of that. So we'll see a more concrete example of this later on when we talk about quantum search. Okay, so this is the black box model. And so now what we would like to see is, can we get some mileage out of this model? Can we use this to see some kind of a difference between classical and quantum computation? So we're going to want to consider quantum algorithms that make use of these black boxes. And in order to do that, we have to change things a little bit. Because notice that this, this picture certainly is irreversible, right, in general. We could have, this could be a string of many, many bits. We put in the index of, one of those bits, but then we get out only a single bit, right? X sub I is either 0 or 1, just depending upon the ith character of the string. So this is not reversible in general. So if we would like to apply this model to reversible computation or more generally to quantum computation, we should come up with a reversible version. And it's easy to do that. We just use the standard construction. So in the reversible version, we're going to have two inputs. So there's going to be an I and then Z, which is something that you would initialize to 0 if you just wanted to simulate the behavior of the normal black box. And then I will just come out on the other side. And here we get the bitwise addition modulo 2. Well, sorry, this is only one bit. So we get addition modulo 2 of the input bit Z and XI, which is the value of the ith bit of the input string. Okay, so this is a reversible black box that we could imagine using if we want to think about black boxes in the context of reversible computing. And of course, we can easily make the quantum version just by putting kets around everything and extending it by linearity. So this will be actually the notion of the black box that we'll use when we talk about quantum computation. And And you know, you should think about this. I mean, really, this is some kind of just the natural extension to reversible computing of this model of a black box. In particular, if what the black box represents is some efficiently computable function. So if you know there's some function that you can compute efficiently to work out what the ith symbol of this string is, you can do that in polynomial time, then you can take that efficient circuit and turn it into an efficient circuit for this reversible version of the black box using the kind of constructions that we saw before when we talked about reversible computing. So this is what we're going to imagine. It's just that we have black boxes like this, and we would like to see you know, an example of some problem where we can solve that problem efficiently, so using not too many queries to the black box, for a quantum computer, and where a classical computer would need many more queries. So that's what we're going to see next. It's sort of the first quantum algorithm, and it'll be an algorithm in this black box model. And because it's an algorithm in the black box model, we'll actually be able to prove that the problem is hard classically, right? So whereas we don't know how to prove things like, you know, p doesn't equal np or factoring is hard, we will be able to prove in this black box model that some problem is hard for classical computers. Okay. Questions? Okay. All right, so this problem that we're going to look at is called the Deutsch-Joseph problem. And this is really one of the first problems that you know, that showed an example of something that you could do fast with a quantum computer and not with a classical computer. So originally there was an example due to Deutsch that just showed something that you could do. Well, you could do it using only two queries so if you wanted to use a classical computer, you would need two queries, and with a quantum computer, you could solve the problem using only one query. So it was a kind of a small separation. This Deutsch-Joseph problem is a generalization to you know, a problem of arbitrary size where you can really see some kind of asymptotic advantage from quantum computing. Okay, so what is the problem? So we're going to be given some bit string. Well, we're not going to be given it. We'll be given a black box for that bit string. But there'll be some bit string x, which will be hidden inside the black box. So we have a black box that hides a string, let's say a string of 2 to the n bits. Okay, so it's going to be the case that the length of the bit string will always be a power of 2. Okay, so I mean, we don't have to, you know, so in general, when we define these black box problems, we don't have to allow a completely arbitrary string to be inside the black box. We can have promises. We can have what's called a promise problem, which says that we're guaranteed that the string inside the black box has a particular form. And this Deutsch-Joseph problem will be an example of this. And part of the promise will be that the string inside the black box will have a length that's always a power of 2. OK. So the black box hides a string of 2 to the n bits. And we're going to be given a further promise that the string is what we call either constant or balanced. So the string x is either constant. So there are only two possibilities for the string to be constant, right? It could be the all zero string, or it could be the all one string. But the other possibility is that the string could be balanced. So balanced means it has as many ones as zeros. So as many zeros as ones. So you could think about, if you like, you could think about this string as encoding the truth table of some function, where you know the input to that function would be like the index into the position of this string. So you know you can index the bits of this string using n-bit strings, right? Because there are 2 to the n characters in this string. So you can, so these things which are called I up there, you can now label with n-bit strings. And you can think about the ability to query the values of this function as, you know, sorry, the values of this bit string x as computing some function at, you know, one of these possible n-bit strings. And so, you know, that function is either a constant function or that function is a balanced function, meaning that it takes the value 0 as many times as it takes the value 1. Okay. All right. So now the problem will be to determine which is the case. Okay. So you have some string inside the black box. you don't know whether it's in this constant case, whether it's either all zeros or all ones, or in this balanced case, where there are as many zeros or ones, and there are, you know, there are 2 to the n bits here. And you want to know which is the case using as few queries as possible. So suppose we want to have a classical algorithm that's always right, so it never makes a mistake. It's a deterministic algorithm. There's no point in using randomness if we're going to demand that the algorithm will always be right. So how many queries will we need to make to figure out which of these is the case? So we're trying to sort of prove some lower bound that says you need to make a lot of queries in order to determine which is the case. So can somebody tell me? Yes. Oh, you have a question. Okay, that's okay too. Yeah. So maybe this was just a bit fast that I mentioned this. This is the way that actually the problem would usually be stated. I don't want to actually write it down that way because I think it would confuse kind of this x with the other x. But because this string, has a length which is the blackbot string has a length that's a power of 2. You could think about that string as the truth table of a function, right? If you had some function where you put in some string of n bits, and it gave you some value, you know, the length of that truth table would be 2 to the n, right? If the inputs to the function are bit strings of length n. So, you know, that might be a way to think about it. And, you know, there's another problem that I may mention if we have time, which is called Simon's problem, where it's really more natural to think about things in this way. But for now, I mean, this is probably more confusing than helpful. So let's just put it aside and say that, you know, the thing inside the black box is a string of bits. It happens to have length 2 to the n. I mean, it will have to be even for this balance thing to even be possible, right? But in particular, let's say it's a power of 2, and we just know that it's constant or balanced. Let's not worry about the truth table of a function thing. Okay, so I think you had your hand up first, so. Yeah, that's right. So this is what we would claim. So a classical algorithm needs. Okay, so when you say 2 to the n minus 1, do you mean 2 to the n minus 1? Or yeah, exactly, right. So 2 to the n minus 1, so almost, you actually, plus 1, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Plus 1, right? Because if you only query this number of values, then it could be you got extremely unlucky and you got 0 every time, but maybe you were in this balanced case. So you don't know whether you're in this case or in this case. So that says that that's not enough queries, so you have to make one more query. And actually, this is exactly the number of queries that you need. I mean, this is a matching upper and lower bound, because clearly there's an upper bound that uses this many queries. The algorithm is just query any set of distinct bits that are, you know, this many. And if you do that, you know, there are 2 possibilities. Either it takes the same value everywhere, in which case the function must be constant, or it takes different values in 2 places. And if it takes different values in 2 places, it has to be a balanced function, right? Because we have a promise that if the function is not constant, it's balanced. So as soon as we see a 0 and a 1, we know it has to be balanced. OK, so a classical algorithm needs this many queries, and this number is sufficient. That says that we need, you know, exponentially many queries in n, right? So we should think about n as the input size to this problem, because every time we make a query to the black box, we're putting in n bits, right? Because this string has 2 to the n bits. So if we want to query one, if we want to be able to refer to one particular character of this string, we need to specify n bits, right? So the log of 2 to the n, which is just n, to specify one of the particular bits of this string. So the input size is basically n. And so what this says is that a classical algorithm needs to make a number of queries that's exponential in n in order to solve the problem deterministically. Okay, so what we're going to see now is a quantum algorithm that solves this problem using only one query. So this is a really kind of dramatic separation, right? I mean, classically, we would need to make exponentially many queries, and quantumly, we can get by with only one query. And we'll actually solve the problem deterministically. So we'll just get the answer out just in one shot. Okay. Okay, so to do this, I first want to show you a little trick, which is what's called phase kickback. And this will be kind of convenient for thinking about the way the quantum algorithm behaves. Okay, so let's remember how the black box behaves. So we give it as input, some string I, which indexes one of the 2 to the n bits of this string, and then some other register in the state z, which if we wanted to just query the oracle in the usual way, query the black box in the usual way, we would put in a 0, but nothing prevents us from putting in a 1 there, because it's this reversible version of the black box, so it's also defined if z equals 1. And this will get mapped to I z plus xi. I mean, I'm just writing again that picture, right? So this is the action of the black box. So now what I want to see is, what happens if I put in this register a minus state. So I'm going to define, these states plus minus, which are just 1 over root 2, 0, plus or minus 1. So these are just the eigenstates of the x operator. And I'm going to see what happens if I take, here I'm just going to think about querying some bit I, and here I'm going to put in a minus state. And let's just see what happens. We'll see that something kind of interesting happens. Okay, so this is 1 over root 2 I 0 minus I 1. Okay, and now let's suppose I make a query. If I make a query, well, I can just, I can just do this on each of these basis states because it's defined by linearity on superpositions of computational basis inputs. So if I have a 0 here, then what appears in the query register is x sub I. And if I have a 1 here, then what appears in the query register is the negation of that. Right? Okay, but now notice that if you of course this is still a tensor product, you can regroup, you always just have I in the first register. So it's just xi minus not xi in the second register. And regardless of what the value of xi is, actually you still have a minus state in the second register. Because if xi is 0, you have 0 minus 1. In other words, you just have the state you started with. And if xi is 1, well, you have 1 minus 0. But that's the same state up to a minus sign, right? So it's easy to see that this is just minus 1 to the x sub I minus. So in other words, if I query the black box with a minus state in the register where the answer is supposed to be written, actually what happens is that the answer goes into the phase. Right? The answer goes into the phase of the quantum state. Now, the global phase of a quantum state, of course, is not a physically measurable thing. So this might seem bad because it might seem like the information went to a place where we can't get it. But of course, we could think about what happens if we take a superposition of different i's. And if we take a superposition of different i's, then this thing will actually be a relative phase, and then maybe we can get some information out of it. Okay, so that's exactly how the algorithm is going to work. Okay, are there questions about this space kickback? Okay. So now let's see what the algorithm is. Oh, yeah.
I
don't know if I can't remember off the top of my head if this particular phrase appears in the paper by Deutsch and Joseph. So they wrote a paper where they described this algorithm. I think it probably doesn't. I'm pretty sure it won't appear in Deutsch's original paper. I don't know for sure if it appears in this paper. It definitely is something that you see in pedagogical treatments now. If you read textbooks where they introduce this algorithm, they use this trick. I mean, this may be something that came later in the original algorithms, but I'm not absolutely sure. We won't see exactly this phenomenon happening. For example, when we look at Shor's algorithm, there'll be something a bit more complicated going on, but there'll be something related to this that happens in Shor's algorithm. So you'll see that there's something else that kind of fits in with this in a fairly nice way. Okay, so let's see how the algorithm goes. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to write down a quantum circuit for the algorithm, and you know, we'll then analyze it and we'll see that it's actually correct, and maybe we can understand why in the course of doing the analysis. I think it might be a little bit difficult to come up with this algorithm, you know, just from what we know now, but at least if I show you what the algorithm is, we can certainly go through the quantum circuit and see what it does.
So it's NP.
Sorry, what's NP?
This process. Well, you're giving
Oh, that's
the
right.
Algorithm.
That's exactly, I see what you're saying. Yes, I'm giving you the, that's right. I'm giving you the answer and we're checking. Exactly. Very good. Okay. So so now notice that, you know, since the string consists of 2 to the n bits, this you know, index I we can represent as a string of n bits, right? So if we specify n bits, that specifies one of the particular characters of this string. So we'll have n bits in this register that we'll represent using n qubits in our quantum computation. And we're going to initially put those n qubits all in the zero state. And then we also have to have an additional qubit where we you know, where we store the answer, basically this qubit, and there we're going to take a minus state. So this is, you know, we're going to use the phase kick vector. So if you want to imagine that, you know, always all of your qubits start in the zero state, fine, you started in the zero state, you apply a NOT gate, you apply a Hadamard gate, and then you have a minus state. But just to kind of, you know, not worry about that so much, let's just write here that we have a minus state. Okay. And now what we're going to do is, well, on all of these zeros, we're going to apply Hadamard gates. Well, I guess I could have just said we're going to prepare all of these in plus states, but you'll see that there's kind of a nice symmetry to the picture if I instead start them in zeros and then apply Hadamard gates. So I apply n Hadamard gates, one of them to each of these qubits, and then I query the black box. Okay, so now here is going to be the query. And then what I'm going to do is on the output of all of these bits, I'm going to apply Hadamard gates. Now this qubit, it's easy to see, will just still be in the minus state. I mean, it'll be decoupled from everything else because we'll be using this phase kickback trick. So you know, this qubit has no information in it, so there's kind of no point in measuring it. But what we'll do is we'll measure all of these qubits. So in a quantum circuit where we measure a qubit, I'll just draw a little picture of the meter. So that means that we perform a measurement in the computational basis on the qubit. Okay, and this is the algorithm. And what I claim is that there's some way of interpreting these measurement results so that you can figure out whether whether the string is a constant string or a balanced string. And notice that in this picture there's only one query, right? So if that's the case, if it's the case that we can infer the result from just these, that we can infer the answer from just these measurement results, then indeed it shows that there's a one query algorithm. Okay, so now let's analyze this. Okay, so you know, first of all, what's happening over here? Well, we have a zero state, and we apply a Hadamard gate to it. Well, that's going to give us a plus state, right? Because that's what the Hadamard gate does. I mean, Hadamard is 1 over root 2, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. So if I apply this to a zero, so something that's in the state 1, 0, I get 1, 1 with this normalizing factor of 1 over root 2, so that's a plus state. Okay. So what I actually have over here is I have n copies of that. So fine, if I apply a Hadamard gate on each of n qubits, so I write that like this, I have the n-fold tensor product of the Hadamard gate on the state 0 tensor n. Or in other words, I just have, you know, just do this n times. Well, I'm just going to get the plus state n times. And there's a convenient way to write this, right? I mean, this is just, I've got a 1 over root 2 to the n out front. And then I just have, you know, here 0 plus 1 tensor dot 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 tensor 0 plus 1. So every possible string of n bits appears here exactly once. So in other words, this is just the same thing as 1 over the square root of 2 to the n times the sum over all x, I'm calling these things I, so I better write I. I in 0, 1 to the n, I. Right? Every possible bit string appears exactly once, and that's exactly the sum that I wrote here, if I just expand out this tensor product. So what that says is, you know, if we think about what the quantum state is here, going into the query, the state of the register that says which index are we querying, it's a uniform superposition over all the possible indices. So this kind of makes sense intuitively because it says, you know, what we want to get out is some kind of global information, right? We're not trying to learn just, you know, one particular bit of the string. We somehow want to learn something globally about the entire string. So let's query everything in a uniform superposition. It kind of makes sense if you're going to have a one query algorithm that you should do something like this. Okay, so this is our input state over here. And now what we want to do is, you know, act with the query and see what happens. So now what we have is a state that looks like 1 over the square root of 2 to the n, sum over all I goes over the whole set 0, 1 to the n, I minus, right? This is our quantum state here. We have a minus state down here. And now what we want to do is perform the query. And let's just use the fact that we're doing phase kickback, right? So we know what happens if we have a minus state in the register where the answer gets written. We get a phase of minus 1 to the x of I corresponding to having the computational basis state I here. So what do we get? So this is 1 over the square root of 2 to the n, sum over all I in 0, 1 to the n, minus 1 to the x of I minus. The minus state is just along for the ride. I guess I'm writing it because it's part of the state, but it's kind of not doing anything. But what's interesting here is that we have a bunch of information encoded in the phases, right? So this is, you know, what I said before, that, you know, here it looks like the phase is not so useful because it's just a global phase. But if we query on a superposition, these phases become relative phases. So now there's some information about, you know, some global information about the string x encoded in these phases, and somehow we want to get it out. Right? Of course, if we were to just measure now in the computational basis, we would just get a random I, and this would tell us nothing. So we have to somehow measure in a smarter basis than the computational basis, and that's what this piece of the circuit is doing. Right? So we apply all these Hadamard gates, and this is somehow transforming the state in a good way so that we can get information out just making a computational basis measure. Is this okay? Questions here? Yes.
So what is the XI
bit? So this is the ith bit of the input string. So there's an input string X. It's a string of length 2 to the n. And so each XI is either 0 or 1. And, you know, as we let I run over the 2 to the n values of, you know, the 2 to the n possible n bit strings, those give us indices into the large string x, the string x that has 2 to the n characters in it, and each of those individual things is just one bit, either 0 or 1.
Yeah, so here, yeah, suppose that xi is like 0, 0, 1, 1, then what is minus I to the x?
So if x is 0, 0, 1, 1, mm-hmm. so this is a case where, you know, I guess little n is 2, right, because we have... you know, we have 4 bits, so we would, so these values I would run over the possible things, the possible values 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. So in other words, this is the, you know, this is the character 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. That's what the I's are, the index of the thing. So then, you know, what would the state be? It would be 1 over the square root of 4, okay, well, that happens to be 1 half, times, you know, you know, we have minus 1 to the 0, so that's just 1 times I, which is 0, 0. And then if we have 0, 1 here, we also have a phase of 0, so we would have plus 0, 1. But then here we have a phase of minus 1 because we have a 1, so this would be minus 1, 0, minus 1, 1. And then we have a minus state over here. Does that help? Okay, so this is the state that we have here. Now we want to see what happens if we apply these Hadamard gates before we measure. So now we're going to apply the final Hadamard gates, and let me just continue over here. So just go like this. So we're going to apply our n Hadamard gates. But actually, maybe I should do a little side calculation first. That'll be kind of helpful. Right, so if we apply a Hadamard gate on on a bit which is either 0 or 1, we get, so let me call this bit B. What do we get? Well, we get, you know, we get a plus state or a minus state depending upon whether B is 0 or 1. So a way of writing that is that this is 1 over root 2, 0 plus minus 1 to the B, 1. Right? I'm just writing out the action of the Hadamard gate on the computational basis state B. We either get the plus state or the minus state, and the value of B determines whether we get plus or minus in this way. And so now if I act with n Hadamard gates on a long string of bits, so this is the kind of thing I have to be able to do, right, to figure out what's happening in this register. What happens? Well, I'm going to get a minus 1 to the you know, value of the bit when I have a 1 here, and otherwise I get nothing. So what I'm going to get in this case is, so 1 over the square root of 2 to the n times the sum over all, I don't know, let me write j in 0, 1 to the n. So minus 1 to the I dot j, j. Right? So because I have this happening on every qubit, so I have a factor of 1 over the square root of 2 to the n, because I'm doing this n times, and the phase that I get here is just determined by the inner product, mod 2, of I and the state j that I'm thinking about transforming to. Right? So this is just the generalization of this to the case where I have n qubits. Is this okay? Maybe you've seen this before? Or? Okay, yes, no? Okay, so maybe I'll say this, since your kind of blank looks don't help me so much to know whether this is okay or not. You're very stoic this morning. So, you know, if you haven't seen this before, this is something that you can check, right? So you can check that the action of n Hadamard gates on a register that stores a string of n bits is exactly this. Okay? All right, good. So now I'm going to use this in doing this analysis, right? So now I have two factors of 1 over the square root of 2 to the n. So I'm going to have here just a 1 over 2 to the n. So I have here the sum over all I, j in 0, 1 to the n. OK, now I have two kinds of phase factors. I have this minus 1 to the x of I. And I also have a minus 1 to the I dot j. Right? So this is just the inner product of these two bit strings. And then, you know, I can take the whole thing mod 2 because I just care about whether things are even or odd here. So minus 1 to the xi plus I dot j. OK, so that's the phase in front of, well, I mean, I have to sum everything up. But if I sum over j, that gives me the phase in front of, if I sum over I, that gives me the phase in front of the state j. And then here I have a minus state. Okay, so this is the quantum state now at the end of the algorithm. Right? So now what we have to do is just perform a measurement. And what we would like to see is that somehow, from the statistics of this measurement, we can infer whether the function is constant or balanced. Okay. So we want to do that. So there are two cases. And the function is either constant or it's balanced. And so let's first think about what happens in the case where the function is constant. Okay, so suppose, I'm saying function, but I mean bit string. I'm thinking of this other interpretation where you think of it as the truth table of a function. But let's just think about the case where the bit string is a constant string. So it's either all zeros or all ones. Okay, so so suppose x is constant. Right? What I would like to do is I would like to compute the probability that I would get a particular outcome j if I measure. So to do that, I have to perform the sum over I. If I do the sum over I, that tells me the amplitude for the state j. So let's try to do that sum. Now in this case there are two possibilities. Either this is the all zero string, or it's the all one string. But in either case, there's just some factor of plus one or minus one that comes out front, because minus one to the x of I then is either always one or always minus one, depending upon whether this is the all zero or the all one string. So in this case, the sum over I, so I in 0, 1 to the n minus 1 to the x sub I plus I dot j. I'm trying to compute this for an arbitrary fixed j. This is just equal to either plus or minus, depending upon whether it's all 0 or all 1, times the sum over all I in 0, 1 to the n, minus 1 to the I dot j. Okay, so now there are two possibilities that we should consider. One is that j is the all zero string. So if j equals 0 dot 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 0, what is this? So what is this sum if this is the all zero string? So if this is the all zero string, then, so there's not going to be any I in the final answer because we're summing over I, right? It's just going to be, well, 2 to the n, right? Because there are 2 to the n terms in the sum. I'm going to get 1 every time. And so I'm going to get either 2 to the n or minus 2 to the n. I mean, there's going to be some global phase that now truly is a global phase that we don't care about. Okay, so this is going to be plus or minus 2 to the n. Okay, well, there was this factor of 1 over 2 to the n, right? So what this is saying is that actually we're going to get this answer, the all zero string, with probability 1. We'll definitely get that answer. So what this says is we measure j equals 0 through 0 with probability 1. And actually, I mean, you can easily see that if you put in any string other than the all zero string, you have to get 0, right? Because we've used up all the probability. I mean, the probability that something happens can't be bigger than 1. So it must be that all the other terms sum to 0. And indeed, you can kind of see that that's the case. Because if j is any non-zero string, you're going to have as many positive terms in the sum as negative terms. They all have the same magnitude, and so they're going to cancel. Right, so the probability that you get the outcome j is 0 for any other j. Okay, so now we see what the signal is that we want to see in order to, you know, in order to guess that the function actually is a constant function. Because if we have a constant function, we definitely get the all zero string. So now what we'd like to see is that we won't be, you know, we'll be able to distinguish that from the case where we have a balanced function. Okay, so let's consider that case now. So if, sorry, where we have a balanced string. So if x is balanced, well, of course, we only have to care about the probability that we see the all zero string. Because, you know, now probably you can guess what the algorithm is going to be. We're going to do this circuit. If, when we make that measurement, we get a 0 for every bit that we measure, we're going to guess that the string is constant. If we get anything else, we're going to guess that the string is balanced. So we just want to see that there's no probability of getting the all zero outcome when we actually have a balanced string. So if x is balanced, what do we have? So we want to compute the sum I in 0, 1 to the n minus 1 to the xi plus I dot, well, let's put the all zero string there. So let me maybe underline that to indicate that it's the string of n zeros. So this is the probability of the zero string. It's this. So the probability of the zero string is just this. Well, if I dot this with zero, I just get nothing. So this is just the sum I in 0, 1 to the n minus 1 to the x sub I. Okay, but what can I say about that sum? It's zero, right? Because I was promised that this string, if it was not a constant string, was a balanced string. So this is actually equal to zero. So if whether the output is the all zero string tells us whether x is constant or balanced. And we only use one query. So this sounds great because we only had to make one query and we could solve this problem that on a classical computer we argued we needed exponentially many queries. But maybe just the last thing we should do before we break for the day is to think about the possibility of having randomized algorithms. So suppose we didn't require our classical algorithm to always be right, but instead we allowed it to flip coins, and it just had to be right most of the time, say with probability at least 2/3. So can you do better than this? Can you think of a better algorithm? Maybe since it's late, I should just tell you what you can do. So, you know, there's a kind of a natural strategy, which is just to query in random positions, right? So the function, you know, the string, the different possible strings are very, very different, right? They're either completely constant or they have as many zeros or ones. So if we just query the string in some random positions, well, if it's a constant string, we're guaranteed to always see the same thing. If it's a bound string, you would guess that, you know, if you look at a few characters randomly chosen, you would see some zeros and some ones after not very long, right? I mean, this is like telling the difference between, you know, someone is either going to generate a string by always saying zero or flipping a fair coin. And you don't have to flip a fair coin very many times to distinguish it from a coin that always comes up heads, right? Just a constant number of times will suffice. So, you know, maybe in the interest of, you know, full disclosure, I should say, but there is a classical randomized algorithm that only uses a constant number of queries. So not just one query. Of course, in one classical query, you can't learn anything about this problem. But using a constant number of queries, so big O of one queries, you can actually solve the problem even with a classical computer if you have the possibility to use randomness. So this is really only a separation between the deterministic models of classical and quantum computing. But it's possible to come up with better examples of black box problems where you can still solve the problem in polynomial time, well, with polynomially many queries and in polynomial time on a quantum computer, and where classically you need exponentially many queries. So there's something called Simon's problem, which is a better example of a problem like this. But what we're going to do next is just go straight on to Shor's algorithm and actually see how you can use similar ideas to solve the factoring problem. OK, so I think I better stop there. But are there any other questions? Okay, so see you tomorrow, and we'll start talking about